Thank you very much for coming along this evening. I'm really thrilled that I'm here and that you're here. I want to begin, of course, with a big thank you to the RHSV for the award in 2012. I nearly fell off my chair, had no idea, and it's just a big thrill. I didn't realise how much it would mean until it happened, and since it's happened, it's meant more and more each week, because it's given our work a profile that wasn't there before. As a small independent publisher, we're not eligible for the Australian Publishers Association awards, and there is a small press network, but we can't enter their awards either because we don't publish widely enough. So we're just out there, and so the RHSV, I didn't even realise then, but now I know it's probably the only real valid important forum for a small publisher like us. So it has given us a bit more profile with some journalists, which has been good. Thank you very much. And it's meant a great deal to me, obviously, as an acknowledgement of the work, and also to my husband Lex and daughter Ginger, who help with the projects always. Ginger's one heck of a researcher and editor, and Lex helps with everything else, and so it's a bit of a team effort. I've roped them into my passion. So we've now got 9 books in our backlist, and they're all on Melbourne themes and Melbourne's history, and trying to bring that to life for different age groups, and so that's what we do. I'm not a historian, I'm just a passionate citizen, and if something occurs to me, I just chase it down until I've found, you know, what it has in it for people, and hopefully bring that to the audience and the reader and the market, if you like, so that there's something about Melbourne to interest everybody, and to try to get people interested in history from whatever place they come to it from. Tonight, I would like to take you on a journey with me through Melbourne's 200 years of art. And as you would know, because there's many more acclaimed historians in the audience than I ever will be, there are many ways to explore history. We can track figures, landmarks, dynasties. But for this history of Melbourne, I've collected up the art of the past 200 years to study how it reflects the development of the city itself and how we perceive the city as it's developing. It's certainly a story of art and its progressions, but for me, it's a portrait of a city unlike any other. Thanks to artists, we can see not only the subject, Melbourne, but the mores, the motivations and the moods of the times. I think it's really revealing, more so than photography. I would like to talk you through that arc of art tonight, and I have some images that will help me do that and show you as we go along. The focus of the images is Melbourne town, not people, not landscape, but Melbourne town. I'm looking at the city itself. It's very rare to be able to study the history of a city in its entirety, from inception to the present day, simply because the histories of most cities exist in such vast proportions, they're unmanageable. For me, they would be anyway. But the sheer youth of Melbourne provides a unique perspective. Settled in 1835, it's only 177 years old, which, as you understand, is just the lifespan of 2 elderly citizens, 2 nanas, I tell children in school. It's just 2 nanas old. And no other city in the world has grown so quickly from tents to towers in under 200 years. It's such a short story, you can almost stand back far enough to see the development, the bands of growth. You can see the landmass still joined to Tasmania. You can almost see each landmark addition to the grid as it appears over the decades. It's such a short history. It's as though, absolutely, it feels to me like it was just yesterday. And because Melbourne's so small and so young, you can actually still walk the city and touch yesterday very easily. And nowhere are these stages of history more marvellously revealed than in Melbourne's art. A study of the collected artistic likenesses of Melbourne reflects, for me, a compelling portrait. The art reveals more than any factual kind of photographic or documented history, because it's within the art that the emotions hover above the colours. They've sort of been inserted by each artist has put their own take into that mood, into that painting. Each work carries that extra overlay, and each of the different incarnations, they seem to be, to me, like facial expressions, or like transitions of mood, or stages of awareness, you know, of discovery, self-discovery, and of becoming what the city eventually becomes. It seems it takes a young city quite a while to get its look right, like a teenager, really. It's not a surprise for Melbourne, because since its first settlement, Melbourne was a place defined where it was not. It was not England. It was not New South Wales. It was not even Hobart. All of those places had far more profile than here. It was not even settled until 50 years after Sydney Town. And then it was not Sydney, and it's been not Sydney for a long time. So it kind of tripped over and stumbled into being, and then, you know, began wrong-footed and ignorant back then in 1835, stolen from the Aborigines by some opportunists from Tassie. But New South Wales soon folded this settlement into its official colonial portfolio, mapping its boundaries and scratching it out in lines on a map. They straightened that all out for good in 1837, 2 years later, with an immutable grid of streets. The grid gave Melbourne a backbone, and it's really the heart of the city and remains so today. But in truth, Melbourne didn't really get going until 1851, when gold was discovered, and it didn't look back. More gold than the world had ever seen pulled the populace to Melbourne's shores, and Melbourne was away. So we have gold rush, riffraff, as well as Britain's finest gentry, all flush with cash, soon adding guilt and pomp and circumstance to their art of Melbourne. And they did turn to art to show the world how fabulous Melbourne was in that decade from the 50s to 60s and beyond. So across two centuries, Melbourne's artists have remained, right up to today, in conversation with their developing city, using Melbourne itself as a character in their works. But despite surges of wealth and success, to her own citizens, Melbourne's often seemed parochial and daggy, raw and unsophisticated. The cultural cringe that dogged the Antipodes has delayed, probably, if not stunted, Melbourne's growth, sense of place, you know, that pride of place, that comfort factor that you have with your sense of place. And just as it was with popular music, where it took decades to replace lyrics about Winchester Cathedral and Route 66 and the Mississippi Delta with Australia's own place names, so it was with popular art. In the early 20th century, paintings depicting our own city seemed a little old-fashioned, corny maybe, gauche, but certainly not the material deemed worthy of the artistic avant-garde. That is, until Bert Tucker in 1939 made Melbourne shockingly surreal, and John Brack made it unforgettably ironic, and Howard Arkley made it cool. And around about then, Melbourne became a subject that changed in the way that it related to artists. So I'm going to have to lean over and click, if I can. I wonder if I can do that in an easier way. Why don't I take this out of here? Can I do that?
Yeah.
Just like that? Yes, I can. Thank you. Yes, okay. That's great. Thank you very much. So Australian colonial art before the 1880s was, until relatively recently, largely unappreciated, derided by the world of the art world of the late 19th century as the unsatisfactory product of Europeans who imported their style and traditions and aesthetic. It was not deemed to be truly Australian. Often the work of the homesick artist who painted for a homesick patron. Colonial art was neglected by the history books for a long time, languishing in the shadow of the later Impressionists, the darlings of the turn of the 19th century. But a reappraisal of colonial art in the 1960s and 70s did lead to new research and publications, particularly on landscape art. But the early art of Melbourne's urban landscape, which is where Melbourne begins, tells a compelling story about identity and place like no other. Okay. In newly settled Melbourne, European artists naturally used their own imported aesthetic and traditions. Their attempts to capture foliage and light and new forms of landscape were not always successful, but they are no less valid for this, yes? I actually think that 50 years from 35 to 85 is really, really important, because part of the great Australian growing up is finding new ways than our inherited mannerisms to represent our own place, our own way. So for all those years, there's this wrestling with British style and British artistic language to define our existence here. Certainly the early painters were limners, not expressionists, but nonetheless their work forms a key feature in the identikit portrait of Melbourne. Colonial art could be said to be the very essence of Australian art, because in as much as it's everything that later artists reject and reappraise and reimagine. The term limner comes from the Latin illuminare, and it means to document and to record, and it applies to the now defunct occupation of itinerant painters who would and portrait painters too of the 17th and 18th centuries. They were employed to document land holdings and civic events, that sort of thing, business and family portraits, of course, but here they documented the city as reportage. This is Wilbram Liardet, who did a fabulous series of portraits of the city. This one here is the flood of 1849. It's just a most remarkable document. Everybody's in there, the police, the sheep, the bridges come unstuck. And when people wonder about why the Yarra River rises these days, if you just look at a few of the next images that I'll be playing, it's really obvious we're on floodplains and nature will have her way. Melbourne used its early artists, as I say, as reporters cataloguing the shape and content of the town, and that work began with the grid. Before Melbourne had even become a city, it was an important concept, a location on a map, an address to be asserted and affirmed, a somewhere to be delineated from what was considered an Indigenous nowhere. Robert Hoddle's grid, drawn onto Robert Russell's map, so you can see the grid here, 8 blocks by 3, until Governor Latrobe said, add a block for me later. It was overlaid on quiet countryside, and it was the ultimate instant city. Just add water, the Yarra River, and there you have a place where there was no place. Outlined by Hoddle as a faint assembly of blocks by a swell in the river, it was barely even there. And, of course, mapmakers were at work at the time, geographically accurate and detailed, but it was the topographical artists that began Melbourne's portrait. The grid became a blanket of allotments, embroidered in a familiar British stitch, quilted into acquiescence, and a series of watercolours later, and the terrible Australian blankness was quantified into a more manageable, habitable, less threatening zone. Now, these watercolours here are painted by Robert Russell from his front door at his little house on the river, and he painted dozens of them, the same view. And just go back again through those three. It's the same view, and he did dozens. They're wonderful. And you can just see the city come up. That's Customs House there. The city comes up in front of him. So despite decades of commentators who claim Melbourne has no icon, the grid has formed the bedrock of all the city has become. In my opinion, the grid is the idea, the big idea. Oops, I've lost the page. I'm so sorry. First, the grid served as a convenient mesh for streets upon which to build a brand new city. Then it served as a conduit for cars, and thanks to Hoddle it was wide enough for us to keep our trams, and also Moomba processions, of course, in the 20th century. And later it became now it's a gamer's labyrinth of laneways for fashionistas and coffee addicts and graffiti artists now in the 21st century. The grid is the cradle of Melbourne. It's the primary organ and the heart of the place. So marketing Melbourne begins, of course, at this time when we're trying to convince others to come and join us down here at the bottom of the world. It was a full-time occupation for many artists, and canny colonial entrepreneurs like John Pascoe Faulkner understood very well the value of artwork, which depicted things the way we would like them to become. A bit of spin begins here. In Melbourne's earliest years, artists were kept busy establishing a vision, postulating success, flattering in portraits and conferring civilisation. Early artworks depicting Melbourne town were often records of a single idea, even a single scene, from the in different styles, and that is Melbourne settled and civilised. It's as though the artists were imagining, dreaming this city into being, you know, into existence out of the ether. And this artistic output became soon a catalogue of infrastructure and a boast. These we sent back to Mother Country to encourage other people to join us. Colonial artists began to overlay a narrative of wealth, the good life, genteel pastimes and civilised living. Picnicking, buggy riding, punting, Melbourne had it all. It was important to early stakeholders to depict a young city as equipped with all the accoutrement of any other established locale, including macadamised streets and gas lighting. This is not a gothic horror show. This is a real boast. This was fabulously new, this gas lighting. This is Ludwig Becker, who was a scientist, and his artwork is incredible because it's a scientist looking at Melbourne. He's forensic, really, in what he sees. And there's another painting of his coming up shortly. His story is a fabulous story. And so with each of these artists, their backstory and their career and their life story informs what they do, and that's what makes Becker very interesting. The list of essential luxuries that was documented includes art itself, and artists contributed to the taming of this great unknown Antipodes just by the very act of rendering it in oils or watercolour. Prince's Bridge here features in many works and still does. Serving as the only major landmark for a long time, it was built and rebuilt, and each carnation required artistic representation. Colonial Yarra crossings began with this punt in 1838, and that's probably about the last time you see an Aborigine as well. They disappear from the documentations of Melbourne's cityscape. But that's Liardet again. And then that was replaced with a trestle bridge, which was then demolished to make way for this fabulous, magnificent, toll-free single span. This is another Ludwig Becker painting here, same fellow that did the gas light. Now you can see here we've got, this is Gold Rush days, we've got Chinese coolies in the foreground down the bottom, a lot of traffic on the bridge and floodplains. That was the only way to get across, and it very, very quickly became inadequate. And so you'll see a few more paintings of the same bridge before it was demolished to make way for the triple span that we still enjoy today. This was opened in 1888 and named for Prince Edward, Prince's Bridge. So artists catalogue all of these bridge crossings. When there's not much else to paint in town, as far as major landmarks are concerned, the bridge was documented from every possible direction. And you can imagine what it would be like here to try to capture the city of the moment, and it being reasonably rudimentary at the time. So as much a marketing job as a study of the scenery, colonial paintings served to build a sense of place and to create an idea of establishment and location. Positives were accentuated and negatives were eliminated. Convicts and Aborigines are absent from most of the paintings of the streets of colonial Melbourne. The art of the mid-1800s described a certain British lifestyle, and much of this early art was designed to encourage investment and convince foreigners as well as Melburnians that all here was civilised. These early depictions of Melbourne can be read as reflections of Australia itself and the nascent national identity. Melbourne remained a province of New South Wales until 1851, and as such it contributed to a description of the greater glory of the colony. Things changed, however, after the discovery of gold in 1851, and in that decade through to the 60s, Melbourne came into its own and began its metamorphosis from a town into a true metropolis. This, I'll just interrupt here to show, I'll play this later on and you can have a close look if you like, but this is covered in brick stacks. Chimney stacks. There are hundreds of them across the grid, forging bricks as fast as they can to build more buildings. You've got the marshlands, no Elba Park Lake, just marshlands. There's actually a game in play on the cricket field there at the MCG. It's a fascinating work, that one. That's a De Grucci. Federation celebration rang out from Melbourne, not Sydney, because Melbourne was just racing ahead as a metropolis. It was dubbed the capital of Australia, as you probably all well know, until Canberra was made ready 27 years later, and its art became more confident and more pompous and more self-aware. Architecturally, the city was taking shape, and it was even renowned for having its own style, a combination of heavy bluestone solidity with embellished with fine detailing. The Melbourne style was a contrast of strength and delicacy and one of the few distinct urban architectural styles in the world in the 19th century. The city soon began its collection of a dazzling array of buildings, and nowhere in the world could a greater variety be found, representing every imaginable historical style and fashion, architectural fashion. And we're very, very lucky that in that space we got some of the diamonds that we still retain today. It's hard to hang on to some of them. They're bulldozed down. By the turn of the 19th century, Melbourne town itself had been mapped, painted, documented and redocumented by colonial artists. Official portraits of major events, including this bridge opening here, had been painted, and the grand colonial city narrative had been well and truly exhausted. This is McCubbin, of course, with the opening of the bridge, and Roberts, Bourke Street. Now, for the most part at this time, the Impressionists came to the fore and they were interested in landscape, not city. So they turned away from the idea of the urban landscape and turned to look at questions of frontier and nationhood in the bush, in idyllic pastoral and inspired by the Impressionists of Europe, as you can see by these works. You know, Turner's on at the gallery at the moment, and this is totally inspired by Turner. But the city wasn't enough for them. They wanted to go bush and do it, so we don't see much focus on the city, the urban space, around about this time. Instead, it was shearing sheep and bush rangers and the landscape, and also the processes of art itself, painting style, which possessed artists at that time. So the documenting of the city was not foreground in their minds. Success of Melbourne's Heidelberg School of Impressionists from 1885 to 1914 saw those big names of Impressionism become the darlings of art and for many years to follow. But they did leave us a few of these masterpieces on an urban theme, which we're very lucky to have. So when we revisit Melbourne, though, through those early years in the new century, we have war. Now, this takes a lot of men away. And although we had been prosperous and optimistic, in this new century, Melbourne finds itself introspective and cast into war and cut off from Europe. Things are quite different in this city. Hard times were evident in the work of people like Danila Vasiliev and Yosel Bergner, who painted portraits of destitute Aboriginals and rough life in Fitzroy. They're not included in my book because they're portraits, not urban cityscapes, but they were very influential on the work that followed them. So in the early decades of the 20th century, we find more women contributing to Melbourne's portrait, and their experimentations with media and with the choice of subject matter help upend the formulaic approach of what had been going on before. Jessie Trail, this is one of Jessie Trail's etchings. She was actually renowned for her cityscapes and construction sites. She didn't do that many in Melbourne, but because most of them are Sydney Harbour Bridge and they're knockout. But focusing on Melbourne as I am, she was ostracised for this sort of work. She was pilloried and, you know, not women's work. But she was fascinated by the growth and the construction of cities and how they came together. And she did the most magnificent etchings. Evelyn Syme also came to the fore at this time. Her woodcuts brought a really contemporary, bold Art Deco perspective to the city's profile. You can see it's very different to what's been going on previously with the Impressionists. Dora Wilson. She was influenced by the Impressionists, and in fact Streeton took her under his wing and promoted her a little. Her work is fabulous. She was inexhaustible in her passion for Melbourne. That is the most gorgeous top end of Collins Street, isn't it? And she was so prolific. She just painted hundreds of works. I said to her nephew, a gentleman who was helping me with this. Now, Dora apparently painted from the back of her car with an easel in the back seat. And he said yes. And I said, well, how could she possibly have done that? You know, she must have had it on the roof or something. And he said, oh, no, cars had tall ceilings back then. And I thought, of course. And these wonderful little things that, you know, it doesn't make sense to me because it's so remote from me. And, of course, it's that simple that a T Ford has a tall ceiling. And that bank, I think, only lasted about 40 years. It's opposite the Gothic Bank. It's a Commonwealth Bank. Fabulous granite pillars and a 9-foot coat of arms on top. Should still be there, but it isn't, sadly. So we can thank Dora for that. And, of course, Clarice Beckett, her work, she connected with the soul of the city in a way that I don't think anybody else has, but she influenced a lot of her successors in their work. You can see, can't you, this introspective style happening now. There's an inward-looking, foggy kind of moodiness that's happening through these years. Two trams, passing trams, that one. Female artists such as these were largely underrepresented by the galleries of the day, and subsequently their work was often bought by friends and family and collaborators. So they disappeared into private collections. That makes it hard to document them for publication. But gallery records do show that Trail, Syme, Wilson, Beckett, and this is Christina Asquith Baker here, were active if not prolific in their studies of Melbourne, urban Melbourne, from the 1910s to the 1930s. Oops, I've done it again. Sorry, I'm driving two buses here, that's what's going on. So the Impressionist movement that captured the heart of the critical art world, and I mean the art world itself drives a lot of what's in and what's out. So you've got gallery owners who influence who's in and who's out, who's popular and who's not. And the Impressionists really did capture that critical art world. And it was seen as unpatriotic, really, to paint any other way. But the nationalist fervour and politics that was swirling around that whole mindset then, this is in the early years of the turn of the century, sent many artists, left them for dead, and they started to look overseas for fresh ideas and fresh inspiration. I think basically it got stuck. Aesthetic got stuck in that phase, and people were hungry for new ideas. And you can see with that introspection there in those last few works, there seems to be a springing off point ready. Not only are the men coming back from war, there's depression, there's a lot of things come together to encourage people to look for fresh inspiration. So locally, art began to reflect that new honesty, as I said, with Vassiliev and Bergner, of empty streets and panhandlers and poverty and neglect. And a new cultural and political sensibility was awakening in the new century, and portraits of the city began to emerge that were more interrogative and critical. Just an aside here, it's interesting that in Sydney's Depression years, the artists there embraced a new world of colour and Art Deco theory called the Colour Theory movement, which basically was a credo that decoration is the life of art and is its justification and its social utility. Well, in Melbourne, a completely different thrust was emerging, and the divergence could not have been more starkly drawn. A group of artists were brewing a revolution in modern painting, soon to explode with such force it would alter Australian art forever. And bigger themes than landscape and patriotism now presented themselves. More visceral expressions than colour theories demanded release. The flip side of nationhood and identity came to the fore, as did the violence of war, sex, death, and poverty, and of course the great Australian silence of the Aborigine. In 1939, Melbourne's Contemporary Art Society held its first meeting and exhibited a collection of French modern art and works by Dali, Picasso, Braque and Van Gogh. As Australia faced another war, the mood became more sombre, and many artists turned to this exciting new art from Europe for inspiration and to the philosophy and politics of Marx for answers. The Angry Penguins was such a group. It was comprised of Sidney Nolan, Arthur Boyd, Joy Hester, John Percival and Albert Tucker. They were all based at Heidi, the home of art patrons John and Sunday Reed. And naturally, it was Heidelberg again, where the Impressionists were holed up. So there's some good artistic voodoo around Heidelberg. And it was from here that Melbourne's most avant-garde modernistic thinking emanated, initially via a magazine called The Angry Penguins, published by John Reed and the surrealist poet Max Harris, and that's where the name of the group came from. These artists defied the traditionalist approach and embraced modernity, influenced by contemporary European movements such as Expressionism, Cubism, Surrealism and the work of Picasso. This was completely different to what was seen by the critical art world as the approved style, if you like. Some of these artists devised their own individualised techniques, painting spontaneously and passionately. Others created quite contrived mechanisms to express their ideas through very deliberate symbolisms. They rejected Romanticism and created a seismic shift in Melbourne's art in the 1940s. So the urban landscape here was the setting for the first and the most definitive series of paintings to emerge from this group. This is Albert Tucker's Images of Modern Evil, which was comprised of 39 paintings created over a period of 6 years. The first of these works were unleashed, and I mean unleashed, on an unsuspecting public in 1943 via exhibition at the Contemporary Art Society, which had by then been taken over by the Angry Penguins. They'd pretty well commandeered the society. Tucker's Images of Modern Evil launched a powerful and confronting new visual iconography that shocked the Melbourne art world. It's a close-up there of this protoplasmic female form. This is Tucker reacting against what is going on. He's just moved to St Kilda and he is shocked and horrified by what he sees on the street. He sees prostitutes, schoolgirls, soldiers, American soldiers. He hates trams. He writes at great length about the terror of trams. They're gnashing wheels and they bear down on you with this threat and menace. and he hated them. And so for him it was a very violent landscape, a violent streetscape, and he just rejected what he saw there. He reacted against that. This is the first interrogation, really, of Melbourne's psychosocial... This is St Paul's Cathedral and a prostitute. first interrogation of its psychosocial landscape, if you like. So we're looking beyond the face into the place, and you can see now this is the first time this is happening in the history of Melbourne's art. Reductive, revolutionary, radical. The series was rejected and reviled by the press, but the genie was out of the bottle. Just 3 years later, Sidney Nolan created Ned Kelly. That landmark series of artworks with the iconic Ned Kelly helmet came from this group. And the story goes, again, Bert Tucker says, that he was painting, working on this sickle-shaped smile and the protoplasmic female torso and this symbology, this very deliberate symbolism. And Sidney Nolan came into his studio and a light bulb went off and he raced out and went back to his studio and created the Ned Kelly leitmotif. So this is, you know, really the hothouse of ideas. Of course, Kelly is not about Melbourne's urban landscape, but this is where this thinking is happening. So it's from Heidi and from Melbourne that Melbourne art flourishes in a new direction. After that first 100 years of colonial painting of contriving the city into being, Melbourne's second century now sees art confronting the city and its place in the world, examining what Melbourne had become. A different relationship now exists between artists and Melbourne, and this time there's no singular viewpoint, no official perspective. Now each depiction of the city belies a truly individual relationship between the artist and place. Tucker's brilliant expressionism, although decades ahead of its time, and in fact so far ahead of its time, he took them all off the wall again, shoved them all into a garage, which is why they exist almost intact. I think 37 out of the 39 still exist, because they were outright rejected, so he put them away. But it inspired a lot of others to look closer at the theme of Melbourne's urban landscape through different eyes. John Brack began his portraits of Melbourne and Melburnians and their heavy ordinariness. And it became clear to Brack that he did not need to travel, as the Impressionists had, as a lot of other artists had, to Europe to find inspiration and technique and to commune with other artists, real artists. Brack realises, as did Tucker, you can do it here. All that you need is right here in Melbourne as far as inspiration and subject matter is concerned. And his visions are riveting. They're clinical, they're comedic. His barmaids and boozers and shop windows and so on, they're so ordinary, they're striking in the subject matter that he chose. His forensic gaze, you know, explores that intimate relationship between the city and the citizen. And the depiction of Melbourne changed greatly through these post-war years. And Melbourne itself was changing. This sweet little top end of Collins Street was changing. The building height limit was broken by Melbourne's first skyscraper, ICI House, in 1956. So the subject herself is doing things, as well as the viewer, the artist who's painting this portrait. The subject, Melbourne, is changing. The height limit of 40 metres had been created in 1886 after the shock of the Australia building in Elizabeth Street. A 40-metre limit was made, and it could only be broken, the rules were, by the spires of churches. And this led to the addition of turrets and towers to many of Melbourne's early 20th century buildings, like you can see here, the T&G on this side, Manchester Unity, also the L&G, the APA, Howie Court, the Century Building. They all added turrets and towers to cheat that little bit of extra height. The 20-storey ICI house, however, in 1956, changed that landscape forever. The marvellous collective irregularity of Melbourne's skyline was soon to be enveloped by a slew of glass towers as conformity and efficiency conspired against the city's architectural assets. So these changes stirred a nostalgia for old Melbourne in a lot of artists, which played out in Michael Shannon's early work. You can see there's echoes here of Brack in the way that this is a very intimate, personal, private relationship with this corner, with the way that, with the shop front, with his relationship with it. It's a very personal existence that you can see here. I love this textural backup. Again, this viaduct still exists down here on Flinders Street. You can go down there now and see it. It's not that far away from us in history terms. I've lost my spot. Now this is Michael Shannon, and this sensibility is a very sort of almost domestic familiarity that he has with Melbourne. I mean, he's kind of embracing Melbourne's dowdiness and ordinariness again. And there's a very tender note about this. This is Prince's Bridge. Very 50s, essential 50s. Again, the viaduct looking back the other way towards South Melbourne. In that same decade, Charles Blackman adopted Melbourne as his new city, and he began his work. Obviously, he's famous for his Schoolgirls and Alice in Wonderland series, but he did begin his painting here by documenting Melbourne's landmarks. So we have Luna Park and the bridge again. In the 1960s, nostalgia continues with Harold Friedman documenting the transition from colonial city to modern metropolis. He revisited some early colonial views of the city, set up in exactly the same position, and redrew the view. That's basically what he did for two books, well, three books, I think, one on Canberra and one on Melbourne. This is the same view here that I drew your attention to a while back, Robert Russell's front door, the watercolours that he painted early on. Southern Cross is gone, of course. And Kenneth Jack, around about the same time, again, this is this nostalgic push through the 60s, he collected up Melbourne's darling old buildings and created a magnificent series of lino cuts. Through that decade, they're fabulous. Very unusual. In the 1970s and 80s, Melbourne's topography gets turned on its head. This begins with Jan Senbergs, who devised this lexicon of built forms from his local landscape in Port Melbourne. And he did a lot of these works, which basically reinvent the landscape, pile it on top of itself. It's very telling about how he feels about the development of the area around him and how it feels to be there. It's psychogeographical, if you like, in the way that he's manipulating that landscape to tell his story. This is also the beginning of Senberg's site-specific work, and he then went on to do most of his work begins and finishes in one story on a place. He'll do many, many, many works on a place, and it began in Melbourne. Geoffrey Smart also did painted essays on the disconnected layers of our urban existence. Now, you don't often see Geoffrey Smart's work in published books, monographs of Geoffrey's work, because the publishers are in Sydney and they always leave out the Melbourne paintings. So this is the junction, the St Kilda Junction. Can you recognise it? The Taiping Cafe is still there at the bottom. It's the Dandenong turn-off. There's another one of Geoffrey's coming up shortly. Through the 80s, we've got Howard Arkley and his psychopop suburbs. I did cheat here. This is the only cheat I've done and put in a suburban image, but there's some Arkley cityscapes coming up. And Rick Amore, he reconfigures and remodels Melbourne to deliver this parallel world to express his emotional essay. This is Market Street, and the back there of the immigration building, looking towards the viaduct and looking towards the river. And there's no river, though, or casino. There's the sea. And this is, I love this about Amor, he just upends things. This actually was already upended by the town planners. It's gone now. Do you remember this on Flinders Street, this viaduct? It used to go up and over, and there's a funny little, see the red car? You used to have to drive up along the side of that car there. It's gone now. They've raised it, and it's near the new aquarium. But it was pretty well a ready-made Amor landscape. The contorting and reinventing of the city's physicality creates a psychographic record of its human history, and it reveals the unstable nature of the idea of place. Artists see things that we don't, and they home in, you know, on the truth of the times. This is underneath the Westgate Bridge. They use romanticism, abstraction, surrealism, cartography, all kinds of artistic tropes to create endless alternative Melbournes that all exist simultaneously. They show us much more than how Melbourne looks, I think. They show us how it feels and how it works, or this is the Ring Road, how it doesn't work, what it means, who we are, and the arbitrariness of Melbourne's creation, shaped as it is by accident and by the haphazard lurches of progress sometimes. And Melbourne's portrait is increasingly disfigured by graffiti, by overdevelopment. Its own disfigurement is coming to the fore. Now, it is, of course, on my part, a conceit to reduce, you know, the immense canon of these Australia's finest artists' work to only those works on a Melbourne theme. But nonetheless, I think it's fascinating to look at how they examined the city, how they visited the idea of Melbourne and of place, and how they use it to express other ideas, and the manner in which they do that. And indeed, some of Australia's finest artists played out their entire career in the idea of place. They found their oeuvre in that idea of place, while others just seem to pass through it, do one or two works and move on. So we come to contemporary Melbourne. This is Jan Sennberg's again. This is one of his recent works. Up to contemporary Melbourne, and in the 21st century, artists making art about Melbourne are enjoying themselves in the space and despite the space. Now, all through this talk, not all these artists are from Melbourne, of course. The early artists are from England and Scotland and all kinds of places. This fellow's from the States, and he thought that this would be a wonderful exercise to do a parody of John Brack and make it relevant to now. I think he's done a terrific job, actually. Melbourne Town is certainly no longer the only subject of the day, and nor is it a cliché to be avoided. This is one of Enza Benincasa's paintings. I love this because it's kind of underwear pink, and it's like it's the back view of a lot of buildings. It's like we're seeing Melbourne's underwear. It's that flesh-coloured sort of, you know, suspender belt colour. It's gorgeous. This is another one of Enza's. Enza's here tonight, by the way. We're lucky to have her here. Artists today use the idea of Melbourne and its features and attributes for whatever ends they deem valuable. They play with Melbourne, they subvert Melbourne, they mock Melbourne, but the cringe seems to be definitely gone. And the city itself is in a constant state of flux. It's a chimera, and it offers all kinds of form to a remarkable array of simultaneous narratives. This is another Rick Amor. You can see the MCG lights in the distance and the Royal Botanical Gardens in the foreground. I love this one, Flinders Lane in the rain. You can smell the greasy rain on the footpath. It's terrific. Today's contemporary artists continue to learn from their predecessors. This is Marco Lucio's etchings, and for me, I can see Jesse Trail's work ringing out loud through everything Marco does. I just think it's wonderful. He's building on that lively energy as a city gets built. He's there at the moment of birth all the time, Marco. He lives on construction sites. Also, this is Yolo Paul Bataro's Tango at the Shrine, which, you know, builds on Christine Asquith Baker's Shrine as well as John Brack's dances, because Brack did a tango dance couple. And Western Australia's Gary Pumphrey likes to come to Melbourne and paint our moody bridges and our moody factories and so on. He's often to be found mooching about under Rickamore's bridges and rifling through Melbourne's drawers for secrets. It's amusing to think how many great artists might be found on any given day examining the zeitgeist under a Melbourne bridge. Rickamore said that he would often bump into Jock Frater and all sorts of other people would go and hang out under bridges down near the West Gate and paint, but now he tells me that the security guards move them on. They don't believe they're painters. And although bridges still reign supreme as landmarks of choice, now we're seeing some new icons appear as the Nilex Towers and Luna Park and the Docklands faltering Ferris wheel join the lexicon. A new realism is also at play as a number of contemporary artists explore the juxtaposition of art and the hyperreal. The acute gaze of the near photographic clarity allows us to inspect the city's most private places. When set at night, this photorealism, it's got a sinister overtone. Now you wonder, is this sinister or just badly lit by the local council? Perhaps this foreboding quality, though, of some of these new artists today reflects that generation born on television and raised on television and film and video game and wanting a more visceral, blacker, thrilling essence from art. Despite Melbourne's modernity, ancient means are still used to render its contemporary portrait, and Marco Lucio carries 9-centimetre heavy copper plates around with him onto building sites around the city and gouges these deep intaglio cuts into the surface to make these etchings. Yolo Paul Bottaro painstakingly mixes egg tempera and pigment and gold leaf to do these works. And Bern Emmerichs, she paints ceramics on enormous ceramic tiles and then fires those. And despite the advent of the laser cutter, this is Miso, also her name is Stanislava. She cuts these by hand, these stencils. Can you see that intricate detail there? She's very focused on her ancestors from Yugoslavia, who are, the embroidery and the handcrafts of women, and that's where she gets her inspiration from. And she's putting women back into the grid by adding these figures astride the portals around the grid. So this is Peter O'Doherty, and he's... Can you see here Clarence Beckett's moody tonal technique? And William Breen. So today's artists are interpreting and remapping the personality of the city as they see fit and rescoping the landscape and folding in that texture of humanity that lies behind the topography. And some of them mock Melbourne, mock its dowdiness or its naivety, or cherish its follies like the trams, or reveal its excesses like this sign writing going on here. And some use the young, impressionable city as an ironic backdrop to parody and allegory, as in this work by Bottaro. This is called Midas, significantly staged at the Art Gallery. And they create depth in Melbourne's shallows, I think, through this wonderful work. Other artists have used Melbourne's lost or overlooked locales as a means to explore powerful emotion or to watch the city straining and heaving into life, struggling with growing pains and the acne of development and identity crises the city has. A city is a direct expression of the level of sophistication of a society, and its streets and its parks and its planning and its architecture reflect the mores of the day. The aspects of Melbourne that our artists choose to portray reveal much about Melbourne. So too do the exclusions. The convicts, the Aborigines, the homeless, the tragedies of the human condition played out in Melbourne's streets remain as bleak and confronting as at any other time in Melbourne's history. And yet there are very few figures in Melbourne's art today. Perhaps the human problems have become synonymous with the state of the city and its it's disconnected, overdeveloped, hyperactive tone. I want to leave you, this is another Shannon here, with the idea that the most powerful art, I think, that resounds through history is a unique product of a very certain time and a very certain place. And I think that's what makes it live for a long, long time. It really captures the moment. It endures. And defining that sense of place and settledness takes time and many generations to build the idea of a city. And each generation has to connect anew with the precarious and constructed identity that's been built before. For Melbourne, this has been an accelerated process. From Britain's blank slate to the world's most livable city in 20 decades is a unique trajectory. In that short time, Melbourne's portrait has been created by artists who've been simultaneously bureaucrats, scientists, suffragettes, junkies, mavericks, businessmen, all sorts of people. And their Melbournes have therefore been variously raw, orderly, demure, romantic, alien, grotesque, implausible, or otherwise. The artist's invocation, artist's vision is always, I think, an invocation of culture and a reflection of culture. I think they bring it up for us, showing us what we are, as well as really cementing that notion of what we are. Melbourne's portrait serves to chart our human course and to protect places and ideas that have meaning for Melburnians. Prince's Bridge was a logical artistic icon, but the Nilex Towers is a new and unexpected favourite. Once immortalised in oils, it's more difficult to demolish the reality. So thanks to artists, it becomes a little harder to erase the touchstones of a community and of history and the lessons of history that they embody. That's my talk for this evening. Sorry it's been a bit disjointed between here and here. If there's any questions, I'm happy to talk to you.